This is the Radio Times President's Day Special. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us today. We're bringing you three conversations about three different U.S. presidents. And we begin with Barack Obama and one of the people most intimately familiar with his political career and his personality, David Axelrod. He twice served as campaign advisor for Obama and served as Obama's senior advisor during the president's first term. His 2015 book is Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. We discuss his thoughts on the ambition and political mind of Barack Obama, as well as Axelrod's views on the broader American political landscape. Let's take a listen. What was your first impression of the first time you met Barack Obama?
It's a funny story, Marty. I met him because a friend of mine called me. This woman named Betty Lou Saltzman is a kind of a doyen of liberal politics in Chicago. And she called and said, this was in 1992, I just met this remarkable young man. He just came back from Harvard Law School. And I think you ought to meet him. And I said, I'm happy to meet anybody. You want me to meet Betty Lou, but why? She said, I think he could be the first black president of the United States, black man to be elected president. And I thought that was pretty grandiose, but I went and I met him. And I didn't, as I said in the book, walk away humming Hail to the Chief. But he was very impressive. And he was impressive in part because he had just come from Harvard, where he was the president of the Harvard Law Review. And he could have written his ticket at any corporation, at any law firm in America. And instead, he came back to Chicago, where he had been a community organizer, to organize a voter registration drive and to practice civil rights law in a small civil rights firm, in a small law firm. And I thought, and as I talked to him, it was very clear to me that he was someone who saw public life as a calling, politics as a calling. I always say the world of politics divides into two categories, one more numerous than the other. The big category are people who run for office because they want to be something. And then there's a smaller category of people who run because they want to do something. And those are the people that excite me. Those are the people I'm attracted to. And I could see from the beginning that this young man, who obviously had ambitions to run for public office, was the kind of person who should be in public office.
It's not clear to me that he likes politics.
You know, that comes up a lot, and it's really interesting to me because it depends how you define politics. He isn't a brilliant guy when he gets out in the campaign trail. He loves mixing with people. Does he love the politics of Washington? No, I would say he does not. I think he gets frustrated with the politics of Washington, the smallness of the politics in Washington. So, you know, and a lot of his attitude toward politics is interpreted through that prism of Washington politics. But I was with him. I remember in 2012 we'd had a difficult period before in the year before going into that campaign. But when he got out on the campaign trail, it was like a tonic. For him, we did a bus tour through Ohio, and just to be able to mix with people and, you know, not politicians but civilians, you know, citizens, he was invigorated by that. And that's who he is.
Well, and we're obviously talking about a complicated person, Barack Obama, but I'm also thinking about how he is on the campaign trail, and then you see his press conferences in the White House.
Yes.
These, you know, 7-minute answers that he gives.
Yes.
And it looks like thinks he's at the dentist.
Yes. Well, we're on radio, so people can't see, but you can attest to the fact that I don't have very many hairs on my head.
Is that
and
Barack
many
Obama's
of them,
fault?
Many of them were lost sitting there in those press conferences as he answered those questions. His attitude was campaigns are campaigns, and you speak thematically in campaigns, and you have a message, and you bang that message. The presidency requires that you answer every question in detail. And, you know, he took to heart too much the old Mario Cuomo maxim that you campaign in campaign in poetry and govern in prose. There has to be some poetry and also some message discipline in the presidency as well. And this was a constant tug and pull between us when I was in the White House and after.
You wrote, I guess it was candidate Obama, Senator Obama, a long letter. This was in 2008, preparing for the campaign. And I just want to read just a couple of lines of advice that you had for him. You wrote, at the risk of triggering the very reaction that concerns me, I don't know if you're Muhammad Ali or Floyd Patterson when it comes to taking a punch. You care far too much what is written and said about you. You don't relish the combat when it comes to when it becomes personal and nasty. When the largely irrelevant Alan Keyes attacked you, you flinched. How did he take that advice?
You know, he didn't react as I thought he would. He took the whole thing to heart. But I honestly, when we began the presidential race, I didn't know the answer to the question. And one of the things about presidential politics, and it's instructive as we look at people toe the line to start this race, is it's an ordeal, and it tests you every day. And you really learn about your candidates in that process, just as the public learns about them. And what happened over the course of that campaign was I saw him take a lot of punches, and I saw his mettle, and so it turned out he was Muhammad Ali and not Floyd Patterson. He could take a punch, and he could handle the adversities of a campaign, and I think that's one of the reasons why the country was willing to turn to a guy who was 4 years out of the Illinois State Senate and make him president of the United States in a very difficult time.
Do you think he has also had to be Jackie Robinson, and by that I mean not throw a punch. I mean, in a way, sort of take a lot of stuff without having to...
Such an interesting question. And I think the answer to that is yes. One of the things that you always wanted to avoid was the inference that he was asking for special dispensation, special treatment, because he was an African American. And, you know, you adjust for that by downplaying the challenges of being the first. And I think he internalized that. And we all did. I mean, I wrote in the book that, you know, there's no doubt that race has played a role in some of the vehement opposition that he's had. It isn't the whole story by any means. Bill Clinton had vehement opposition as well. But no other president has had someone stand up in the House chambers and yell, "You lie," at him. No other president has been persistent, has had his citizenship persistently and ridiculously questioned. And I think these are a function of who he is and what and his background and the resistance on the part of some people to embrace him as a symbol of a diverse America.
But he also has been criticized, maybe more from the left than from the right, being the first African-American president, that he has not done enough to address the problems of discrimination, our racial legacy. Yes, he did talk about Trayvon Martin and some other incidents, but I think people were thinking he had this bully pulpit to help us understand and address our legacy of racism, and he hasn't done it to their satisfaction.
Right. But my answer to that is twofold. One is everyone has to understand the circumstances under which this guy became president of the United States. We walked into that door as essentially a triage unit trying to save the American economy from collapse. We were told there's a 1 in 3 chance of a second Great Depression. We met for months several times a day as the economists sort of took the vital signs of the American economy. And, you know, and this was in the midst of two wars and other challenges as well. And there's no doubt that had we arrived at a different time, we would have apportioned his time, and he would have apportioned his time differently. I think he has, especially in the later years, begun to address these issues, and Eric Holder at Justice has begun to address these issues very directly. And I expect he's going to do more of that in the next couple of years. But job number one was to save the country from a calamity of untold proportions. And within that, by the way, he was the guy who fought for expanded earned income tax credit, refundable tax credits for the working poor, expanding Pell Grants. Health care reform itself helps people at the lower end of the economic scale, you know, in an important way, working poor who don't qualify for or didn't qualify for Medicaid.
Well, he gave a very famous speech just across the street from us when he was running for election the first time in response to Reverend Wright.
It was amazing. And I wrote about this in there. Well, the thing that made that speech most amazing, and you know, you say when you raise the Floyd Patterson, Muhammad Ali thing, that was probably the single biggest event that persuaded me that this guy could be the president of the United States, because there was a storm raging about Reverend Wright, his pastor, and some of the things he had said, and it erupted on a Thursday, and the president on a Friday night said, or Senator Obama, you know, this thing's going to engulf us, and I want to address it, and I want to address the larger issue of race in our politics and in our country. And he said, and I want to do it by no later than Tuesday because I don't want this thing to go on. Well, he had campaign events scheduled Friday, Saturday. We had a film shoot on Sunday and campaigning here in Pennsylvania where the primary was going on Monday. And he said, I have to write this speech. I said, when are you going to write this speech? He said, don't worry about it. Just schedule it. So we scheduled it for the Constitution Center on the theory that if you're going to go down on a big stage. In earnest, he worked on it on the Sunday night before the Tuesday morning speech, wrote half of it. We went to Philly. We went to Pennsylvania and campaigned all day. He came back to the hotel at 9:30 at night and finished the speech at like 2 or 3 in the morning. And I woke up and saw it on my BlackBerry, and I'm scrolling it. I'll always remember standing there in the dark scrolling this thing. I emailed him back and said, this is why you should be president, because it was such a profound statement. And, Marty, the last thing I'd say about it is the next day, you know, the news media was descending like vultures on Philadelphia thinking this could be the end. His supporters were incredibly tense. And I was in the green room with him before he gave that speech, and he was completely calm. And he said, look, the worst thing that can happen is people won't accept what I say, and then I won't be president of the United States. He said, but I'll still have said what needed to be said. And he said, that has some importance too, so don't worry about it. We're going to be okay. That grace and wisdom at a very difficult time for his candidacy was indicative of something very important. And I think voters interpreted it that way as well.
What do you make of the fact, and this goes back to 2014, number of Democrats running for election or reelection didn't want the president to campaign with them. Some of them wouldn't even say whether they voted for him or not when it was clear that they obviously had. It was like they were allergic to his presence.
Well, my suggestion is that you ought to ask them, and they have got plenty of free time now because all of them lost. And what is the lesson in that? The lesson is you can't run away from a president of your own party. You know, and the answer we always got back was, well, as you know, the senators don't want you out there. The Hill doesn't want you out there. They think you'll be a burden. Well, he was a burden to them because they muzzled him, and they took their best weapon off the battlefield.
We're almost having a break here, but are Democrats scaredy cats?
Well, I suspect Republicans have made such mistakes in the past too. But there's no doubt. It wasn't a smart decision, and I'll leave it to others as to whether it was a courageous or scared decision.
That was my 2015 conversation with political advisor David Axelrod, who worked alongside Barack Obama as a campaign advisor and in the White House as a senior advisor. His autobiography is Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. When we get back from the break, we'll hear my conversation with John Meacham about the political life of George Herbert Walker Bush. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Radio Times President's Day special. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for tuning in today. George Herbert Walker Bush served just one term, but presidential historian John Meacham argues that Bush 41, as he's known, was able to accomplish more than most people give him credit for. He says that politicians of today could learn from Bush's pragmatic approach to governing, which was sometimes very politically unpopular. Meacham wrote about H.W. in his book Destiny and Power and joined me in the studio when it was published. We talked about Bush's rise through the military to CIA director and finally to the presidency. Let's take a listen. So why did George Herbert Walker Bush want to work with you on this biography?
I'm going to use a technical term. I don't want to overwhelm you, but I groveled.
Did you?
I wanted to do it. I had first met him 17 years ago in 1998. Michael Beschloss, my friend, the historian, and I had gone to Walker's Point in Maine, and I immediately understood in a way I had never before when I met him how he had become president of the United States. He possessed a quiet, persistent charisma and embodied very clearly a fading order of public service. He had more in common, has more in common, I think, with Franklin Roosevelt and Theodore Roosevelt and even the founding fathers than he does with his successors. And when the opportunity arose and he said that he had these White House diaries, that I just jumped out of my chair as fast as I could, because what he did a couple of times a week for 4 years is he would dictate into an audio recorder. So in many ways, and the book draws heavily, the presidential part of the book draws heavily on those diaries, it's as close as most of us are going to get to being president. He's a one-term president, but he had enough action in 4 years that most people get in eight. The fall of the Berlin Wall, the first Gulf War, the budget deal that set up the prosperity of the 90s, the terrible 1992 campaign, the end of the Soviet Union, tumultuous time, quiet but deeply ambitious and competitive president at the heart of it.
Looking at his childhood, his upbringing, I mean, it seemed like a very stiff upper lip. It had a kind of British feel to it.
Externally, yeah. And that's one of the fascinating things is, yes, you're right. If you were looking at this boy growing up, born in Milton, Massachusetts, grew up in Greenwich, spent the summers in Maine.
Boarding school.
Andover, boarding school, Yale, the war. You would think of him as kind of having just stepped out of a John Cheever story or the Brooks Brothers catalog. But he is more complicated than that. He's more interesting than that. He would not have become president of the United States if he had only been that. If he hadn't moved to Texas in 1948 after the war, wouldn't have been president. The Democrats wanted him to switch parties in the early 1960s, back when there was one-party government down there. He refused. He barely got on the ticket with Ronald Reagan in 1980. Neither Bush would have been president had Reagan actually cut that deal with Gerald Ford. So his life is full of these near misses, and great biography, I think, is always the story of tension. And the tension in George H.W. Bush's head and heart was the mission to serve, taught him by his family, to whom much is given, much is expected, but the drive to succeed. And to serve in the way he wanted to serve, someone had to win, someone had to lose. And so you have this wonderfully complex interplay of ambition and service and duty all rolled up in this lanky guy from Greenwich. Yes, you know, he came from a privileged background, but we weren't really hiring him for that. 1989 to 1993 was a time of immense change in the world. And if I had told you, if you and I had been sitting here in 1980, and we would have said, all right, in 12 years' time, in a decade's time, the Soviet Union is going to cease to exist without a shot being fired, we both would have thought we were just whistling Dixie. And yet, because of both Ronald Reagan and George Bush, American leadership played a critical role. You know, they didn't end the Cold War. You know, the peoples of Eastern Europe, the peoples of the republics of the Soviet Union, the countless acts of courage, you know, it was their desire for freedom and independence that drove it. But Reagan helped and Bush managed it. I think they needed each other historically.
Those two, and Bush.
I do. I think Reagan did things that Bush could not do in articulating a case for the West. And I don't think President Reagan could have handled the management details of the 4 years where George H.W. Bush. And, you know, go ask Mikhail Gorbachev.
In fact, you have an interesting several scenes where Bush sort of holds his tongue in a way to give, I'm not sure it was exactly saving face, but it seemed like Gorbachev really appreciated his diplomacy.
Here's a connection between childhood and the presidency. In childhood, George Bush was known as half-half because whenever he had a treat, he would cut it in half and give the other kid half the dessert, half the candy bar. Cut to 1989, the Berlin Wall comes down. He's able, half-half Bush is able to put himself in the shoes both of Gorbachev and of those to Gorbachev's right in the Soviet Union. He's able to imaginatively see how he would feel if his system was falling apart. And he knew that the possibility of a violent reaction from Soviet hardliners was a real possibility. And one factor, and we all forget this, one of the reasons he thought that in November of 1989 is why. What had happened in June of 1989? Tiananmen Square.
Of course.
So he had seen a repressive regime take military action against protesters. The wall comes down. He plays it very cool. The Democrats and the press think he doesn't understand what's going on.
Because he's not celebrating.
Because
right?
he's not celebrating. What he's doing is he's trying to prevent another Tiananmen. And he doesn't get credit for it until now. But it was a brilliant diplomatic move, and it was based on his character.
It's hard not to think about those particular skills at that time and whether they would have would work today at all, you know, dealing with all the dictators and the and ISIS in the world, you know, whether those kinds of skills are translatable.
I'd love to have the chance to find out, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about a man who is the un-Trump. I mean, someone who spent his life training to be president, someone who ambassador to the UN, envoy to China, chairman of the Republican National Committee, director of the CIA, vice president for 8 years.
Those would be disqualifiers today for a number of people.
You can't. You couldn't be nominated. I mean, imagine that paper trail. Just for any one of those jobs in particular, the UN votes, having run the RNC during Watergate, even though he called on Nixon to resign, he did it late. Director of the CIA, who China, 4 years in Congress. He was a George H.W. Bush is a figure out of a world that has vanished politically. And that, you know, centrism is not always the right answer. The middle way is not always the right way. But sometimes it is. And sometimes you need someone whose ambient reality is actually doing the business of governing. And that's what Bush did.
Well, some of his comments about Dick Cheney when he was vice president in his son's administration. Also, Donald Rumsfeld when he was secretary of defense in his son's administration has gotten a fair amount of attention, calling them both hard asses or iron asses.
Iron asses,
I should say. And about Cheney, he said he seemed knuckling under to the real hard-charging guys who wanted to fight about everything, use force to get our way in the Middle East. He criticized Cheney for sort of creating his own department within, I guess, the Department of State. Rumsfeld, and I have a feeling that there's some rivalry that goes back between George Herbert Walker Bush and Donald Rumsfeld, but he doesn't seem to like Rumsfeld very much, calling him arrogant.
Which is probably the worst thing that George Bush could call you.
To call you arrogant?
Arrogant. I think that's true. President Bush, 41, offered these criticisms to me in interviews from October of 2008 through about 2012. I confirmed all the quotations with him again last year before publication. He believed that his son's administration had an overly hawkish tone. He worried that Cheney was too eager to project force around the globe. He thought that Rumsfeld had failed to revisit decisions once made about the conduct of war, of the two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. To my knowledge, it's the first time he's ever been this direct, this honest on these three questions. He said that he did not believe his son should have used the term axis of evil, that hot rhetoric was good at getting headlines but might not be diplomatically useful. And I think the reason he told me these things, I think, is he believes in the historical record. Mm-hmm. A man who keeps a diary for all those years wants the record to reflect reality accurately. And I think these were his issues with what happened. I don't think he thinks that Dick Cheney was really the president. I don't think he believes that, as he put it, you know, George W. was not some dolt, some dummy going in there. He did, that conventional wisdom is not right. And I don't think he disagreed with him radically on the actual decision to go into Iraq.
Different times, but different response to Saddam Hussein.
Different wars, different reasons. They both told me, and strategic environment was different. But even more than that, 41 wrote a letter to his son saying, you know, ratifying his course. Mm-hmm. And in his own war in 1990-91, he was willing to risk impeachment if Congress had not given him the authority to go in, and he used the language of good versus evil. So to some extent, was he criticizing his son, something that he was uncomfortable about himself? He wouldn't be the first human being to do that.
He called Lynn Cheney a iron ass as well, and seemed to think that Lynn Cheney and their daughter had undue influence on Dick Cheney himself.
Yeah, he was trying to figure out why the Cheney he had known as Secretary of Defense seemed so much more conservative. Cheney was always conservative, but he did bring Lynn and Liz into it. And Dick, Vice President Cheney, whom
he
I
didn't like that.
Well, he wore the iron ass label with a certain amount of witty pride. He did say that he did not agree with President Bush's putting it off on Liz and Lynn. They're two formidable women in their own rights. But it's interesting that that's what 41 was sitting around thinking about.
Yeah. What does he mean by iron ass?
Iron ass means inflexible,
data
resistant, stubborn to a fault. And it's funny. I spent a long time on this book, and it may be remembered for the phrase iron ass.
Here we are talking about it on the radio.
Where's Bill Sapphire when we need it? The etymology of iron ass.
Let me ask you about Iran-Contra, because I have to say that even as you write about it, and clearly this is a man you respect and have a lot of admiration for,
sure,
that this was a really dark time for him and perhaps a time when he really went against whatever his values were. And is lie too strong a word?
No, I don't think so. He initially denied that there had been arms sales to Iran. George Shultz goes to him and says, "You were there. You got to knock this off." The argument, as people may remember, was George Shultz, the Secretary of State, and Caspar Weinberg, the Secretary of Defense, were arguing against the Arms for Hostages Initiative. The National Security Advisor, Oliver North, who was working for the NSC, President Reagan and President Bush, Vice President Bush, rather, were more or less for it. It was a misguided policy, backfired in many ways, and it made Bush appear to be someone who was not being fully candid by saying he was not in the loop. He knew plenty, and in fact leaked to the newspapers what he knew. I think it's an unusual.
Why did he do that, though? Why do you think he
did it out early? Get it out early before the 88 campaign. He didn't like the idea that we were working through a third nation. It was going through Israel. So I think it's an uncharacteristic moment, but it was a Machiavellian one, where he was having to balance staying close to Reagan, who remained popular with the Republican base, and keep himself out of trouble. That's one of the things about Bush that I think is important, and a lot of Democrats I've talked to who about this have said that, this is the last Republican president they can really sort of get behind at all. And Iran-Contra is an exception to that. But this is a man who was never really deeply ideologically wedded to either side, left or right. So he was not driven by a fervor in the way Oliver North was. So much so that he was such ultimately a pragmatic figure as opposed to a movement conservative that when he was president, he passed the Americans with Disabilities Act. He transformed almost every building in America for the disabled. He violated his own no new taxes pledge to put the country on a stronger fiscal footing. He signed the Clean Air Act, which is essentially still our environmental policy. He had a much bigger domestic record than people have appreciated. And I think the reason people don't appreciate it is it was too liberal for Republicans to embrace. And Democrats didn't want to give a Republican president too much credit. That's why history in this case matters. This book is my attempt to look at him whole and biographically. It's not a book about it's not a political biography. This is his whole life. And when he fell short, as he fell short on Iran-Contra, as he fell short on failing to explain why he broke Read My Lips, He fell short because he was human and frail and given to sin and shortcoming like the rest of us.
Do you think he was also ruthless? I'm thinking about the campaign against Dukakis, the Willie Horton ads. I mean, the way that – and there were some others as well.
Yeah. I think that he was willing to say and do what he needed to do to win. What ultimately redeems him, in my view, is that whatever he did on the way to amassing power, once he had that power, he was able to put the country ahead of his own political interest. My favorite example is in 1964, when he was running for the Senate in Texas, he opposed the Civil Rights Act, now a piece of American scripture. But what does he do in 1968 when he's actually elected to Congress? He votes for open housing, lifting racial discrimination from the real estate market. So he opposes the act on the campaign trail, the big Civil Rights Act. But when he has a chance to vote for a civil rights measure, he votes against his constituents' wishes. He goes down to Houston, gets screamed at for going out and selling out to the left. He is one of the last figures of the American center.
That was my 2016 conversation with presidential historian John Meacham about his book, Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. Next, we'll talk about President John F. Kennedy with historian Robert Dalek when our President's Day special continues after this very short break. Stay with us. This is the Radio Times President's Day special. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. The tragic assassination of John F. Kennedy cut short the life of one of America's most beloved presidents. Kennedy was the youngest president to serve, the first Catholic to hold the office, and his legacy created one of the most prominent families in American politics. I discussed the early days of the Kennedy administration with historian Robert Dalek, covering his cabinet selection process and the effect that the failed Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba had on him and on his decision-making process. But first, we're going to listen to the announcement of Kennedy's death from Walter Cronkite, broadcast on CBS on November 22, 1963.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
You know, listening to that, and you and I are old enough to remember that fateful day, and we kept in Walter Cronkite's long pause there, because when you hear his crack in his voice, you hear the sort of crack in that sort of wall of the newscaster.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, Marty, I don't think the country has gotten over that killing yet. In fact, what I find so striking about it is that in 1901, William McKinley, who was a popular president, a Republican who had been elected to a second term, he was assassinated. 50 years after his death, hardly anybody remembered who he was, but not with Kennedy. Part of it, of course, is television and the fact that the media has so captured his image. But there's a lot more to this than just the television. And he has a phenomenal hold on the world's imagination.
Well, is it because he was attractive? He had an attractive family. He was young. There was this sort of Camelot patina over his administration and his family.
It's all that. I think also it's that the Kennedys have become an American dynasty. It's not the Roosevelts. It's not the Bushes. It's the Kennedys. And what makes them so attractive to people in this country, I think, is on the one hand, they are the fulfillment of the American dream. The Irish Catholics from Boston who Joe Kennedy made a fortune, became so famous, so wealth and fame attached to them. But at the same time, they're star-crossed. So much tragedy. The oldest brother killed in World War II. The oldest sister killed in a plane crash in 1948. The president assassinated. His brother Robert running for president in 1968. He was assassinated. John Kennedy's son, John Jr., killed in a plane crash, senseless plane crash off of Cape Cod. And Jacqueline Kennedy dying in her early 60s of cancer. Ted Kennedy, the horrors of Chappaquiddick and the young woman who dies in that accident. So it's just one thing after another. But I think the country identifies, on the one hand, with their phenomenal success, but also with the tragedy, because people have things that they suffer through in this life, and so they have these dual reasons for being drawn to the whole family. But Kennedy himself, I think, is enormously appealing because the image of him, you're quite right, there is the Camelot aura that surrounds him. But it's more than that. It's the fact that people are not enamored of the successors. Johnson with Vietnam, Nixon with Watergate, Ford's truncated presidency, Jimmy Carter's failed presidency, the two Bushes, the second Bush under a cloud leaving because of Katrina and the Iraq War and the economic downturn. And so there was a poll, a Gallup poll a few years ago, asking Americans to assess the last nine presidents from Kennedy to George W. Kennedy had an 85% approval rating. The only one close to him was Reagan with 74%. And so people want hope. They want a better day. And they think of Kennedy as someone who could have done that.
But could have.
Could have. Could of have. Course. Of course. We don't know. And they don't know. But they invest in him in a sense. He's tabula rasa.
Well, a kind of a projective test, because I've read people who say, well, Kennedy was a peacenik. No, Kennedy was a warmonger. No, Kennedy was a liberal. No, he was he was a conservative.
And it
seems that people want to project onto him their perhaps fantasies about who they think he was.
He's become a mythological figure, and you're exactly right. People project onto him. He was a compulsive womanizer, which he was. Does it bring him down? No. He covered up his health problems, which I revealed in that first book.
I remember that, yes.
In that first book. But it doesn't bring him down, and so there's enough there that people attach to him and have this regard for him, this affection, one might say.
Well, you describe, and I'm sure it's true for every president, and it was certainly true for Kennedy, which is that transition from a grueling campaign, and here you are, you know, you win the office, you become the president of the United States, and this kind of, what are we going to do now?
Right.
And everyone is exhausted on top of that.
Exactly. And, you know, he kind of withdrew instantly after the campaign, and he complained to his father and said, this one wants that one wants this, and joke with him and said, listen, Jack, they haven't counted all the ballots yet in Cook County. If you don't want to take the office, you don't have to do it, you see.
Was a ruthlessness in this family, was there not?
Was there ever? There ever? Yes.
But I'm assuming every president, you know, picks a cabinet with the idea that they will give the best advice or this will be my sounding board.
Right.
Was that true for Kennedy?
Yeah. But you see, he picked people. It was partly the consequence of the very close election. He only won by 118,000 votes. And he was concerned to create a kind of bipartisan administration, a national government, if you will. And so he keeps J. Edgar Hoover on as head of the FBI, another conservative, Alan Dulles, as the director of the CIA. And he appoints Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, who was a moderate Republican. He didn't know him, never met him, but had a fabulous reputation as the president of the Ford Motor Company and a brilliant young administrative director.
But no Pentagon background
experience. No, none at all. And McNamara said to him, I don't know anything about administering the Defense Department. Kennedy said, I don't know anything about running the presidency, he said, but, you know, we'll both do it. And then, of course, he appointed Dean Rusk, who was a very passive sort of a character, and that's what Kennedy wanted. Of course, he wanted to control foreign affairs. Mm. He had the people surrounding him. The Secretary of the Treasury was Eisenhower's Treasury Secretary, C. Douglas Dillon. He didn't know him. The only one he really knew was, of course, his brother, Robert, who he made attorney general. And somebody said to him, you know, you're going to get yourself into political difficulties with this kind of nepotism. He said, look, I need someone I can put my feet up with and talk to candidly. And that's the role that Bobby played. More than that, I have a chapter in the book called The Robert Kennedy Advisor in Chief. He didn't have a chief of staff, Kennedy. But Bobby Kennedy was essentially the chief of staff.
And he also sounds like he played the role of the enforcer on top of that.
Without question.
I mean, he was more willing to be direct and overt about throwing his weight around.
And, you know, Marty, we will never have the many, many conversations I'm convinced they had behind closed doors that were not recorded, that were not put down on paper. And people would say they'd come into a meeting with Bobby and the president and several other people, cabinet officers, whoever might have been CIA, defense, Pentagon officials. And Bobby would drop the dime on somebody or other. And Jack would sit there with a slight smile on his face. And the supposition was they knew what was going to be said. And the president wouldn't say it. He didn't want to come down on one side or the other, but Bobby was sort of reflecting what he was thinking.
The kind of good cop, bad cop approach to foreign policy in many instances. I think fiasco or disasters is a good description of the Bay of Pigs. This started early on in Kennedy's presidency.
Yeah, when he came into office, he was under the gun to find some way to topple that Castro regime in Cuba. Now, there was a plan that the Eisenhower administration had already put into place. They were training these Cuban exiles in Guatemala in preparation for a potential invasion. And Kennedy was skeptical about all this for a couple of reasons. One was he had put forward the Alliance for Progress, and the idea was sort of drawn from Franklin Roosevelt's notion of the good neighbor. Look, they are very suspicious of us in Latin America with good reason, that we are the Yankee imperialists, and we want to reestablish good relations with them, and we want them to enjoy a degree of prosperity and progress, because otherwise they are a proving ground for communism. And Castro has gotten in there, and he's a subversive force in the hemisphere. So we need to get him out, but we don't want to just do it as gunboat diplomacy. Let's do this in a way that advances these Latin American countries and ends some of the poverty in those countries. The assumption Kennedy understood later was that I'm a new president. I can't fail. And if this invasion is stuttering, I'm going to have to send in American troops. I'll have to.
Well, he was, as you write about, just absolutely furious about this failed, disastrous operation.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, here he is at the start of his presidency. His inaugural address had given the country hope, a sense of a new day. The torch had been passed to a new generation. And there's an excitement about his, and he's the youngest man ever elected to the presidency at the age of 43. And what happens? A disaster. And Khrushchev wonders, you see, and Kennedy understands this. Yeah. Khrushchev is going to see me as an easy mark now. And so it's a real setback for them.
And this is a quote from the president about the CIA and the military's poor judgment. Those sons of bitches with all the fruit salad just sitting there nodding, saying it would work.
Yeah. He just, you know, one of the things that is central to this book was the extent to which Kennedy was locked in conflict with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Mm-hmm. and he battled with them, particularly over nuclear weapons. He was determined not to get into some kind of conflict that would require the use of nuclear bombs. He said at one point to this young mistress, this Mimi, he said, "I'd rather my kids be red than dead."
Wow.
See, he never could have said that in public. But it was the measure of how concerned he was not to fight that nuclear conflict. So Kennedy then has a meeting with the Joint Chiefs, and they describe what the nuclear war plan would be, which included dropping 170 weapons on Moscow. They point out hundreds of millions of Russians, Eastern Europeans, Chinese would be killed in a nuclear war. As Kennedy walked out of the room, he turned to Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State, and said, "And we call ourselves the human race." See? Mm-hmm. He was so chagrined by that. So he doesn't trust them. He doesn't accept the idea that, and of course this came to a head in the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Sure. But one senses then the loneliness that a president like that can have when dealing with people who have sort of Dr. Strangelove views of warfare in the world.
Oh, yeah. It's because who's going to be blamed later? John Kennedy started the nuclear war. John Kennedy fought the nuclear war. John Kennedy killed 170 million people or whatever it was. So he was intensely mindful of that. And also what it would have done to the world, you see. You know, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who he had held at arm's length throughout the crisis, he calls them in. They wanted to invade. And, of course, he resisted. He wanted, tried diplomacy first, and, of course, it worked. Afterwards, when he meets with them, they said to him, "Mr. President, you've been had. Khrushchev is hiding the missiles in caves." Well, they leaked this to the press. Khrushchev writes Kennedy a letter and says, "I don't live in the caveman age. In essence, I'm no caveman, you see. But we need to make a plan," they tell Kennedy, you know, "invade, bomb." Okay, they make contingency plans. The plan they made included the use of at least one nuclear weapon on Cuba. If they had dropped a 1 megaton nuclear bomb on Cuba, it would have turned the island into a pile of rubble, let alone what it would have done to the south coast of Florida. But they had this rationale that they could contain the collateral damage, you see. So Kennedy, he just saw them as a little strange, bizarre. But, you know, Marty, what you have to understand is that these guys, the generals, they came out of World War II. How did you win that war? You bombed Hitler, the Japanese, back to the Stone Age, you see. And when you're fighting an adversary like Hitler, the Japanese military, Stalin, the Soviets, you got to beat them to the punch. This was their attitude. We're responsible to win such a war. We have the advantage in these weapons. So in some ways you understand why they thought that way, but Kennedy was the responsible authority, and happily he operated with brilliant restraint.
That was my 2013 conversation with presidential historian Robert Dalek about his book, Camelot's Court, Inside the Kennedy White House. And that does it for the Radio Times President's Day special. Thanks for joining us. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Bilder and Trine Nuri and John Ahrens, who also edits this show. I'm Marty Moscoe.